Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode, I was joined by Dr. Charlotte Fox Weber to talk about boundaries, relationships, and separation. Charlotte is a psychotherapist and writer. She co-founded Examined Life and is the founding head of the School of Life Psychotherapy. She grew up in Connecticut and Paris and now lives in London with her husband and two young children. And Tell Me What You Want is her first book. This episode focuses on what we mean by boundaries and explores how we can use them in the context of relationships, separation, and divorce. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. Welcome, Charlotte.
Hello.
It's lovely to have you. Thank you very much for joining me. Charlotte, we're going to chat about boundaries today, and I know it's a subject that's close to your heart, and it's definitely close to mine. But let's start with the beginning kind of question. What are boundaries?
Boundaries are used as a term in such an unboundaried way that it's ironic. It's rules, limits, parameters for negotiating and connecting and managing space in every sense with other human beings.
Okay. And I guess what we're talking about today really is the boundaries around divorce and separation, and specifically any boundaries that would be useful when you're negotiating things like how you're going to co-parent or what your financial arrangements are going to be like when you divorce and separate. So can you give us some examples maybe just to bring the idea of boundaries to life? Because you're right, it's a really sort of nebulous concept. And I hear myself saying it all the time, well, yes, it's really good to have boundaries. And I often challenge myself and say, what do I actually mean by that? So in that divorce and separation scenario, what would be some examples, do you think, of boundaries that people might have?
I think they're the boundaries that you keep with yourself in a way. So I think self-protection is a really important boundary as the kind of starting point. If you don't want to reveal certain things, or you feel like you're going to be vulnerable in company, whether it's with an ex or with the ex's family or even friends or work, I think it starts with clarifying for yourself what you want to talk about from your story and what you don't want to talk about.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes I think we feel compelled to answer when somebody asks us a question, don't we? Particularly when we're going through something traumatic, like a divorce. People say, oh, how are you feeling? Or what are you doing? Or have you thought about? Or, oh, I heard this or I heard that. And you're expected to come back and fill them in on the details and the gaps in their understanding. And I think that's quite hard, isn't it?
It's really hard. It can be really unhelpful, especially if you are fragile and then kind of outsourcing your sense of worth to unworthy authority, because you can find yourself at fragile moments absorbing feedback from someone random who you don't even necessarily like or trust, and it can be out of control very quickly. And I think that just knowing for yourself when you don't know what the story is, when you don't even know how to talk about something. I mean, when you're in the midst of trauma, it's also very difficult to explain and give a kind of coherent update about the trauma to other people.
So one of the big boundaries then, it sounds like, is that sense of having a boundary around self-protection and self-preservation. Is that what I've understood from what you're saying?
Yes, and being comfortable, knowing that it's never exactly perfect. I think boundaries are not ever entirely clean and ideal. I mean, we have a kind of concept of them, but there's no guarantee that every aspect is going to be exactly agreed upon by other people, and intrusions and missteps happen. But I think one of the things that can go wrong with boundaries and talking about a split up or explaining anything about a relationship is when people make light of something and then feel misunderstood for giving that update, if that makes any sense. Like if it happens in grief as well, if you happen to be kind of blithe and feeling okay on a particular day and then you seem nonchalant, I think that is another kind of, it can be an almost self-betrayal. It's another kind of disruption to what you want people to think. So I think that boundaries really connect to control in that way.
So you think we're trying to find a sense of control because we feel out of control with a trauma or something that's going on, like a divorce or a separation. And so we're trying to use boundaries as a way of wresting that control back, do you think? Or is it something slightly different?
Yes. And I think it can be a way of systematizing communication and kind of having authority and resetting dynamics. And sometimes, I mean, it can be a power move when you want to weaponize boundaries or kind of establish things in your own way. It's a response to chaos very often. And having some order and systematizing can be really helpful. But I think that also recognizing the limits of boundaries is very consoling in a way that even if you put everything in place and you're a police officer emotionally, it's not going to be an entirely perfect system.
So boundaries sound like an aspiration, kind of like how we describe amicable sometimes. You know, sometimes being amicable when you separate is an aspiration rather than a reality. But it doesn't mean because you fall at the first hurdle, you should give up. You can keep going with that aspiration because that will take you in a certain direction. And it sounds like that's kind of similar with boundaries.
Yes, completely. And I think sometimes it's worth reminding yourself that if you overstep a boundary or if someone asks you a question and you find yourself answering, you are allowed to put limits in place as you go along. It's not as if it's kind of whatever you sign up for. So I think that the fluidity and sponginess of boundaries is also important as a kind of philosophy for redefining how we relate to other people.
Yeah. So it sounds like, I mean, is it the case that maybe when you're going through a separation, you might want to take some time out to sit down and think about what your boundaries are, particularly, for example, around the communication and what you are and aren't going to say to people. Do you think that's a useful strategy or is that overkill?
I think it's really useful. I think that it is helpful to be radically honest with yourself about the dark, twisted feelings and fantasies that you may. If you can be onto your kind of savage side, your beastly side, and really kind of confrontational with yourself, I think it is massively liberating and empowering and also can keep things safe. Because I think when we don't admit the darker side and the darker ways we may be wanting to kind of exact revenge or punish someone who's been hurtful, when we think that we are blameless and innocent entirely, I think it can actually kind of set us up for self-sabotage and out of control behavior in more complicating ways. So I think starting with whatever it is that you are kind of secretly plotting and then going from there.
So it sounds to me like rather than trying to put a veneer of niceness on this or a veneer of amicability, you should actually be very ruthlessly honest with yourself. Think and say the things to yourself that are your, you know, deepest, darkest confessions almost. And only from that point, when you've been that ruthlessly honest, can you then move on and put boundaries in place with other people?
Yeah. So, I mean, for instance, revenge is something that gets a really bad reputation as a motivation. It's not considered a great motivation. And yet it is completely natural as an aspect of why we make certain choices. And whether we admit it or not, revenge is alive and well universally in different ways. And it's not always the driver, of course, but I think that we get very kind of sanctimonious in defending our motivations. Like there's a lot of pressure, especially if you have been victimized and abused and mistreated and harmed. I think it can be really, really kind of contradictory feeling to then hold yourself accountable for the revenge you want. But I think it's a mistake to believe in your own innocence,
okay,
in anyone's innocence. I mean, psychologically.
Yeah. So if you're going through a divorce and separation, you're listening to this, then the takeaway so far is maybe around connecting with that honesty. And if you're motivated by revenge or some sense of justice or whatever it is, whether it's attractive or unattractive as a label, then the important thing, it sounds like from what you're saying, is that you need to connect with that and own it and admit to it and get comfortable with it.
Yes. And I really want to now defensively say, I am not suggesting that we should blame ourselves or kind of be hard on ourselves. I think it's just a relief to say out loud to yourself or to a friend or a therapist or someone you can trust, actually, I want to do that for all of these dark reasons. So I think once we are onto our shadowy side, then we can be rational and strategic in a more congruent way.
So I guess you're not talking about acting on some of these feelings, but you're talking about psychologically recognizing them and owning them, aren't you? And looking at genuinely what's motivating you, and to be able to then almost put that in a box and stand back and say, okay, if these are the things that are really pulling me strategically, what do I need to do with this information? And what do I need to do if I'm having to, like you say, you might want to enact revenge on one level with somebody that you're separating from. But if you've also got to be a co-parent with that person, then you're going to have to find a way of navigating two contradictory sets of feelings, aren't you? And I think that's one of the things, I watched your TED talk, and that's one of the things you were saying, when you've got to live with the two sets of contradictory feelings. On the one hand, you've got this idea of, I've got to be a co-parent. And on the other hand, you've got all these feelings of rage and anger that you might feel towards the other person. How on earth does somebody make sense of that and put a plan together to be able to co-parent when they've got those feelings underneath? What sort of things do you help people do in that scenario?
I think that separating the psychological from other areas of life is really important. It's yet another boundary in a way. So I work with lawyers who will sometimes refer to us and to this group of therapists I work with, and we cross-refer, but there are so many differences between legal ways of speaking and anything psychological. So in therapy, people can talk about wanting to kill someone and their murderous rage, and it's fantasy. And the difference between fantasy and reality is a huge, important aspect of therapy. And I think if you kind of have those moments of radical honesty with yourself and you want to write an email, you can write the email without sending it. And there's a lot to be said for all of the work that goes into communicating and then not actually communicating to the person you're having the strong feelings towards. So I think that kind of knowing the difference between your inner world and whatever you choose to do behaviorally is a really important step.
And do you think then, because I suppose lots of traditional therapeutic approaches would say that you have to master those uncomfortable feelings in order to be able to move on and do the practical day-to-day co-parenting or whatever it is. Do you subscribe to that, or do you think you can hold?
No.
Okay, tell me more about that.
I think there can be a lot of pressure to be over something, to move on, to let go. And the amount of people who have said to me, either in my work or my personal life, that they thought they'd be over this relationship because a certain amount of time has passed, or they gave themselves a deadline. They've had enough. They're fed up. Why are they still kind of hung up on someone? And grief is never linear. And I think that recovering from a relationship breakup is not a linear process, even if you're no longer together. I think there shouldn't be pressure to have everything be tied up in a nice bow, even when legally things are kind of resolved and okay.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I agree. I think you're right. There is tremendous pressure from just culture, society, the way we talk about things, and I include us in this, that we have to somehow, you know, go through something, come out the other side. We use that language all the time, don't we? Get to a place where we can be at peace, we can have moved on, we can have got over. That's all super prevalent in our language. And it's very interesting to hear somebody actually say, well, you know what? You can still sit with those feelings of hurt, of betrayal, of anger, of bitterness, whatever they are, and you can still do the other practical stuff. That might be getting the legal stuff tied up and being strategic in the way you approach that. It might be putting the best interests of your children first and creating, you know, a functioning parenting relationship between the two of you. But none of that is predicated on you having to have got over, come to terms with, or got through the emotional turmoil that you feel when a relationship ends. It's fascinating.
Yes.
And it's liberating. Don't you think it's liberating?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it is totally liberating when you realize it's like having an extension for an essay. Like it's okay, actually. You don't have to be completely past this thing. And I think that sometimes it's possible to really have made significant progress emotionally in dealing with the loss of a relationship. And then you have a relapse. You have an emotional kind of reopening of something, of a wound that you thought had healed. And there can be this sense of kind of going back there when you'd made progress. And again, I think it's nuanced, it's contradictory, and it's possible to make progress for 20 years and then have a day where you find it really hard and you miss someone or you're unresolved. And it's part of the richness of life as well. But I do think that there's a lot of pressure, particularly since no-fault divorce, actually. I think that that increased the pressure to have things be okay and healthy and can be over any acrimony. And even if legally everything is peachy and has never been hugely inflammatory, that doesn't mean there aren't kind of private battles happening.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because it's been heralded, and I would concur that actually taking the fault out of divorce has been a real positive move forward for people. But you're right, it's positive as long as we don't pretend it's not there. So it's positive to take it out of it being the state's business or us having to declare to the state why our relationship has broken down. I think that's really positive to remove that because it's just for me. It's just none of their business, the state. But I see and I hear what you say. We can easily get sort of pulled into this idea, seduced by this idea that actually that means people aren't angry, upset, or hurt when they divorce because we're not writing it down on a piece of paper anymore. So it's really interesting to say, where do you go with some of that anger at the beginning of the process these days?
I mean, therapy is certainly one place. And I think that so many people need acknowledgement privately at the very least that harm has been done. Whatever the kind of public explanation is, it's one part of the story. It's not the entire truth. So I think the contradictions are important.
I think that need to be heard and to have somebody bear witness to your story, as you just described, is absolutely right. I think huge value is brought by being able to tell your story to somebody, whether that's a therapist or whoever, or a friend or a family member. But I think having somebody else hear your hurt and your pain, I think that's one of the things that allows people to be able ultimately to move on. But I'm interested in just what you're saying there about boundaries. Do you feel ultimately you've got to have mastery of your own boundaries and to be able to set boundaries, you know, within as a precursor to then being able to work with boundaries externally, so with another person? So do you think you have to master it yourself and your own relationship with you, kind of in the way that we talk about, you know, you've got to love yourself before you can go out and love somebody else? Is it the same with boundaries?
I think that even the pressure to love yourself before you love someone else is a tall order, because there are sometimes when you actually really dislike yourself and it can still be possible to form a loving relationship. I think that when we wait for things to be so clear and orderly, then it's setting up a kind of perfectionist mindset in a way. And there's no perfect way to deal with relationships. So your question was, should we kind of master boundaries for ourselves personally before having boundaries with other people? I think knowing that we will get it wrong and then we will try and try again, and it's a work in progress. I think sometimes we have to advocate for ourselves more than we can expect a kind of system to advocate for us. So with boundaries, one of the shockers, it happens at work, it happens in friendships, happens in pretty much all areas of life. That realization that no one else is actually thinking about your experience as much as you are and advocating for you. Like if you don't say that actually something doesn't work for you, no one will necessarily know that it's a problem. That sounds incredibly obvious, but I think a lot of us still have, and I definitely am one of these people, but still have a fantasy of being taken care of being protected somehow, whether it's our parents or a spouse or friends or culture. And it's that childlike part of us where we think that it'll be okay. Our needs will somehow be met. And actually, no, we have to be responsible for ourselves in that way, which is hard.
But why do we find it so hard? Because I wonder if there's something cultural at play here. We find it quite hard to say what we want because it feels pushy or we're frightened we won't get our needs met. But I think it's more about feeling pushy or it's rude to ask or all of that sort of plays into it, doesn't it? And we end up therefore not saying anything and allowing resentment or whatever to build. So what do we need to say to ourselves or what do we need to just get over in order to be able to feel okay about saying, look, this is what I need right now?
This is why I like to begin with the outrageous demands, because it kind of normalizes our own internal space for the wackadoodle requests and the kind of diva demands and the bare minimum needs. And I think we are really judgmental about desire. And then we're even judgmental about the loss of desire. I think it's fascinating to look at the ways we all fake wanting something or not wanting something, needing something, not needing something, to see how we've gotten into certain situations.
Go on, this is interesting. Give me an example. So like in a divorce or separation scenario, what do you think people are faking most typically?
So there are certain things that get faked a lot, I find. I mean, besides orgasms, which aren't necessarily faked as much these days as they were 10 years ago, although I think it still happens. There can be a kind of make-believe domesticity that happens at the beginning of a relationship where somehow a partner can fall into a mode of kind of making the house nice or earning money. And like the roles and responsibilities just get allocated and put into place for who does the washing up, who does which chore, and even who is the kind of storyteller, who's the creative one, like all these unofficial rules and roles. And then what happens over time is there can be a realization that you've been miscast or you are restless and bored with the role you've been playing, or you just no longer can believe that you ever put up with taking on a certain responsibility. But we all have moments of outrage that we somehow signed up for this job that we didn't exactly spell out emotionally. So there's no one without needs, and it's not a dirty word to have needs, but I think if we're not explicit with ourselves, then there's almost no possibility of it magically happening.
Do you think we suffer from a lack of vocabulary about it? Then what's the, because I think we can all intellectually accept, can't we, that we have needs. We'd like to get our needs met. We probably don't get our needs met a lot of the time, and that's okay. And then there are some really important things where we really need to push for it. But what stops us then? Because I feel like you're right that we get trapped in certain roles and sometimes it's easier to leave rather than just say what we want. How can that be though? Because that sounds ridiculous when you say it, but that is the experience
but
of lots
happens,
of people.
It happens in friendships all the time too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to make it a thing. It's fine. It's fine. And then it pulls the relationship.
Yeah, then it's not fine. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that it's embarrassing to actually say what you need. I think it can be a lot more comfortable to recognize another person's needs. And that's how it begins. So we are conditioned to think about giving pleasure, but also if you are taking care of someone and It could be within a marriage, it could be with children or parents, but it can be the kind of caring persona of wanting to look after other people, wanting to sacrifice yourself in some way. And I think that sacrifice is still a big thing. It's a big pressure that we can find ourselves going along with. And it can even be embarrassing to admit that you're not sacrificing something because it sounds greedy or it sounds selfish. And there's still a kind of shaming that can happen or that happens. It's part of politeness. And even the way children say, "I want milk," you wouldn't say, "I want that" in a restaurant. It would sound kind of rude. So we go around. We think it's more polite and delicate to kind of not be too demanding and too overt, but then it gets extreme.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because we spend a lot of our cultural upbringing, as you say, being polite and socially well brought up and all the rest of it. And then you get to a scenario where a relationship is breaking down and all of a sudden things start to change and things become, the language change, things do become more demanding, things can become more heated, and people, out of perhaps fear or necessity, are much more clear about what they need and what they want sometimes. And it's just so interesting to see that shift in dynamic, because it's the same person, it's the same personality, but maybe something around context allows us to articulate our needs in a different way.
Well, also, I mean, it's paradoxical because we are the same and yet we change. And I think that when we commit to relationships, it's really easy to forget that change will happen, that either it'll be personal change or circumstantial, contextual change, but it won't feel exactly the same forever. But it's very hard to kind of conceptualize how different we might feel in the future.
You know, if someone's going through a relationship breakdown and they recognize the need to set boundaries, and perhaps they've done some internal work themselves, they've got some idea of where their lines are and what is and isn't acceptable. How do you set up a conversation with an ex to talk about boundaries, whether that's about how you're going to navigate the divorce process itself, whether it's about co-parenting, whether it's about, you know, bringing in a new partner, for example, if you share children and now you're separated? How do you start a conversation about boundaries in that scenario?
I think it depends on how manageable the ex is and how reasonable and kind of respectful. I think if there can be a degree of respect, I might even say respect before I would use the word boundaries, because I think it's the precondition for even having a conversation. And when it's disrespectful and vituperative and attacking in the dynamic and communication, it's really almost too dysregulated to kind of set up new systems in that moment. So I think that if you're in the heat of having horrible, horrible fights and attacking each other, feeling attacked, saying something about respect being essential before you can engage is kind of step number one.
It sounds like there's almost a hierarchy of what has to be in place, doesn't it, to have the conversation. And is kind of emotional regulation at the bottom, respect next, and then your boundaries? Is that the order, or is there something else missing in that sort of triangle?
I think that sounds about right. I mean, it's not going to be fun necessarily, but I think that that is the bare minimum, respect. And yeah, boundaries, a close second to respect, but there's no reason that respect should not be honored going both ways. It's never okay or justified to not have that be in place.
I always think, when I think about boundaries and learning about boundaries, I think the place that I learned most about boundaries was probably in therapy myself. And, you know, when you train to be a therapist, as you know, you have to have a lot of personal therapy. And for me, I think that's where I actually got to grips with what boundaries were in a healthy and safe space, because when you're in a relationship with a therapist, it's a safe space, isn't it? So, you know, it's always, it kind of feels like sometimes on the podcast, we're forever recommending going to see a therapist, which I think is probably not a bad shout, but it does really feel to me that, you know, if you're going to learn about boundaries in a really fundamental way, then you need them modeled. You need to understand and feel them and see them in action. And the safest place to do that is in therapy. It's really hard, as you say, to think that your first foray into boundary setting is going to be with somebody that you feel angry, upset with, or potentially murderous about. So I kind of, without wanting to sound obtuse about it, I kind of feel that, you know, if you want to learn and you're interested about creating boundaries and using those boundaries throughout all the aspects of your life, the starting place for me feels like therapy. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
I love the way you have described that. And I think when there is a good working alliance, that is absolutely a place for testing out new ways of relating and boundaries and having the experience of boundaries being respected. A little bit of psychoeducation about these things, I think, is really important too, so that if you're in therapy and your therapist is making you feel uncomfortable about boundaries, having a sense of what's okay and what's not okay is really, really important.
That's really good advice. Where do you get the psychoeducation you mentioned just there? What do you recommend?
I would say Yalom is a very beautiful writer about boundaries, and also he pushes them. He definitely gets cozy and is kind of radical and humanistic. So if you want to think about boundaries in a way that isn't just psychoanalytic.
Yeah. We'll put that link on because Yolan's a good shout. We'll put the link for that if people are interested onto the show notes as well, because I think that's a really good place to start with boundaries. I'm just conscious of time. What about any final tips or advice for people when it comes to boundaries, Charlotte? What would you say?
It starts with just being curious about it in yourself and not judgmental.
That's lovely advice. Thank you. Where can people find out more about you, Charlotte?
Oh, on Instagram, Charlotte Fox Weber. Psychotherapy.
Okay, brilliant. And what about your book? So tell us a little bit about your book.
My book it's called What We Want in the UK. It's called Tell Me What You Want in the US. Cultural difference.
Yeah.
It's out in paperback now. And it's about desire and the different ways we have underlying dark desires.
Sounds brilliant. Definitely worth a read. Thanks so much for your time. You can find out more about me. I'm on X at @Kate_Daly. You can hear about new podcast episodes by subscribing for updates and visiting thedivorcepodcast.com or your favorite listening platform. Charlotte, it's been a pleasure chatting this afternoon. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you everyone for listening.